What are the real roots of conflict in the Middle East? Is peace impossible to achieve? Once again, Jerusalem commands world attention as a proposed new apartment complex to be constructed on privately owned Jewish land in East Jerusalem sparks massive Palestinian protests and riots. Now, according to Yasser Arafat, by the provocation of attempting to build these apartment complexes on largely privately owned Jewish land, it is as if a declaration of war has been proposed by the Israeli government against the Palestinian Authority. Just before that time, another Hamas suicide bomber blew himself to bits, killing and injuring Jewish men, women, and children in a busy coffee shop in downtown Tel Aviv. That resulted in a visit to the bereaved families by Jordan's King Hussein and Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu. The two leaders then held a joint news conference expressing their sympathies for the victims and their families and once again calling for a return to the so-called peace process. Is the peace process, like the shattered bodies of innocent victims in an Israeli coffee shop, now dead? World leaders speak of peace, peace. Read Jeremiah 6:14 in that regard, which says, peace, peace, when there is no peace. But instead, there is a constant series of brutal killings. A suicide bomber blew himself to bits, along with 19 civilians, on a crowded bus in Jerusalem on March 3, 1996. Almost exactly a year later, a Jordanian soldier mercilessly shot down helpless Israeli schoolgirls, chasing them down the street as they screamed, and he was pumping bullets from his automatic rifle into their bodies. Hardly a week goes by, but that we learn of yet another act of murderous terrorism in Israel. In March 1997, Prime Minister Netanyahu said, "The peace process is in a shambles." But why? Why all the hatred and the violence? Why do so many Arabs hate the Jews? Why do so many Jews hate the Arabs? Not all, that's why I said so many. Why non-stop killing in the Middle East? And why non-stop killing and hatred for such a protracted period of time that it goes back virtually to the dawn of history? Why has it gone on, not just for decades, but for centuries in that troubled land? To understand the depths of the problem, you need to know the history of Jerusalem and Palestine, something about the ethnic and religious roots of the peoples who lived there. Jews trace their roots to Jerusalem from the very beginning of recorded time. Not only has it been speculated that Jerusalem is the site of the original Garden of Eden, it's also said to be the site of the near sacrifice of Isaac by Abraham on the very mount where the famed Dome of the Rock Arab Mosque is located today. Jews trace their national and historical claims to Jerusalem back to the time of David and Solomon and even long before, while many Arabs believe it was their ancestors who were dispossessed of their lands when Israel, as they say, invaded Palestine following the Exodus under Moses. Muslims believe the site of the Dome of the Rock, that famed gold-gilded building which is always dominant on the skyline of any camera shot you will see of Jerusalem, is where their prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven, so they say. Christians, nominal Christians, revere Bethlehem, Jerusalem, and its holy places, as they're called, because of the ministry, the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Christ. The city of Jerusalem is a monumentally important holy site to the three great monotheistic religions of mankind, a city which is named after peace, allegedly deriving from Jebus, after the Jebusites who inhabited the city prior to David's time, and Salem, shalom, as you know, is the word for peace in Hebrew, or Salem, meaning peace. It's believed that Melchizedek, the king of Salem who met Abraham and to whom he paid tithes, was either a human priest and king, a type of Christ, or the very personage of the Godhead who became Jesus Christ in the flesh. And if you read Hebrews 7, 1-3 in that regard, you will come to the inevitable conclusion that Melchizedek was, in fact, the very personage of the divine Elohim, Godhead, who became Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Down through history, Jerusalem has more often been the city of bloodshed, conflict, and war than the city of peace. Today, depending upon to whom you listen, Arab or Jew, it's always the other side which is intractable, which does not truly want peace. The term bloodthirsty terrorist state seems shocking when it's applied to Israel. Yet that's exactly the ordinary people's view in Syria, where 26 years of an oppressive military regime under President Hafez al-Assad has held the population in passive submission. Fed a constant diet of horror stories by their government-controlled press, ordinary Syrians read front-page articles of alleged frequent arrests, kidnapping, and torture of innocent Syrian Golan Arabs by Israeli soldiers. Israel is blamed for everything that goes wrong among Palestinians, Iraqis, Egyptians, Saudi Arabians, and many other Arab states all the way to Libya. Syrian newspapers continually trumpet angry diatribes against the beastly, as they say, Israelis, hotly condemning their stop-at-nothing determination to hold on to the Golan Heights captured from Syria in the 1967 Six-Day War more than 30 long years earlier. A mysterious bomb blast tore apart a bus in downtown Damascus on New Year's Eve 1997, killing 11 civilians and wounding over 40 others. For weeks, the official Syrian press hailed the blast as the work of the evil Israeli Mossad, the Israeli secret intelligence agency. Surprisingly, even the intellectual community there swallows whole such reports. Outwardly, the Syrian government portrays itself as willing to negotiate peace with Israel, of course, but meanwhile, all of the propaganda continues nonstop inside that country. And by the way, it's known that Syria has obtained advanced Scuds and Silkworm missiles from China and North Korea, and strongly suspected that they possess chemical weapons. Syria maintains a sizable army of around 500,000 men and has a large air force equipped with state-of-the-art supersonic jet aircraft. For Israel's part, Syria is viewed as a country that openly harbors, even sponsors, terrorists who operate all over the Middle East. In a cover story in the Jerusalem Report for April 3, 1997, there was an exclusive interview published with Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak, who warned of an explosion of Middle East terrorism. And this was his response to the building of the apartment complexes in Jerusalem. And he said the atmosphere between Egypt and Israel would remain cold for a long time to come. In a freewheeling discussion, interviewer Ranan Luri, and by the way, he is a political cartoonist for the Jerusalem Post and quite well known, and has lampooned and ridiculed many of the Arab states and the situation over there, so it was quite a coup for him to be able to sit down and to interview personally President Mubarak. He asked, and I quote, "President Mubarak, will there be a war in the region?" End of quote. Mubarak's answer, "It's not a question of war, but a question of terror that will be 10 times worse than anything we've seen before. Embassies, airplanes, diplomats will be exposed to attack. There's uncontained hatred here. It's terrible," end quote. Of course, it's obvious where he was laying the blame. In other words, the building of that apartment complex, and prior to that time, the opening of the tunnel along the wall, which then devolved onto the streets of Old Jerusalem, which would have taken tourists, which it does because they opened it, on into the old city, so that they would now be milling around in the streets where there are dozens of Arab shops selling everything from rugs to jewelry. And that was such a provocation that massive riots and demonstrations broke out and people were killed as a result. So President Mubarak, when he answered, "Will there be a war in the region?" said there will be 10 times worse terror than anything we've seen before, and it's as if they simply can't help themselves. It's as if when the Jews decide to build apartment complexes for housing on unoccupied, open, rocky, hilly terrain on privately owned Jewish land, the inevitable result is vicious rioting on the part of the Palestinian Arabs. Many assume that the Palestinians would happily set up their cherished state with East Jerusalem as their capital and Yasser Arafat as their president if land could be traded for peace. Continually, the Western media emphasizes squabbles over territory. So the underpinnings of the religious hatred and the ethnic hatred and the historical mix of both of those gets lost as the liberal media continually tells you only about 0.1% of the top of the iceberg and makes it appear as if dirty little old Israel is determined to deprive these poor Palestinian people of their own state. Well, continue to listen closely. Listen to this tape 2 or 3 times, because many of the things you're going to hear are going to be quite surprising. Now, to the average person today, bombarded by the liberal American media, it would seem that if Israel gave back the Golan Heights, gave back all of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, in other words, if Israel retreated to her pre-1967 borders, the borders she occupied from 1948 and their War of Independence until the Six-Day War of 1966 or 67, a wonderful peace would settle over the land. All would be well. Israel would once again have a narrow waist of only 10 miles from Latrun to the Mediterranean, and there would be a Palestinian state. Many assume that they would then elect, of course, Yasser Arafat. Syria would once again look down upon the Sea of Galilee from the steep heights on its eastern shore, and, as I said, Israel's waist would have shrunk to a mere 10 miles from Latrun to the Mediterranean. Now, you've only got to research the history of the region from the Israeli War of Independence in 1948 until the 1967 Six-Day War to determine whether or not such a restructuring of the political map of the Middle East would bring a lasting peace. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rode to victory in the elections because he stridently opposed the concept of trading land for peace that his predecessor Yitzhak Rabin had so repetitively emphasized. And he was on the very process of a step-by-step trade of land for peace to accomplish just that. Even the widow of that former slain prime minister, whom I knew personally, had interviewed on a number of occasions. I'd had him in my office. I've had lunches with the gentleman. I've shared the podium with him in field questions from Ambassador College students. Yitzhak Rabin was a very warm, a very lovable man, a diplomat, a statesman, a former general, and a former member of one of the Israeli organizations which in its own time sought to wrest control of Israel away from the British. Leah Rabin, however, blamed Netanyahu's fiery rhetoric for inciting a right-wing young Israeli to assassinate her husband. Among the many principles upon which Netanyahu ran were that Jerusalem is non-negotiable. Jerusalem is the sovereign capital of the state of Israel and will never again be divided. He said there will never be a Palestinian state. He said, we will negotiate over the Golan Heights, but only in very careful consideration of Israeli security. That Jewish settlements in the West Bank would be continued, and that he would never go along with the step-by-step trading of land for peace that had been the policy of his predecessor. Well, as the months passed, however, and after all of the riots and the hurried emergency conference in Cairo, the other one down at Sharm el-Sheikh, to which President Clinton himself went, Netanyahu began to soften the rhetoric and appeared willing to make concessions. Eventually, the Oslo Accords were signed, stating the principles upon which the opposing parties were willing to negotiate. After many additional acts of terrorism in Israel, riots in Gaza, Hebron, and other West Bank towns, Netanyahu finally ordered Israeli armed forces out of Hebron. When the newly armed Palestinian police, 30,000 of them, now given arms by the Israelis, so that the Palestinian police now have their AK-47s. They eventually, however, turned those automatic weapons against the Israelis. And as a result of that brief blow-up, where an awful lot of people got killed and hurt, Israel once again clamped down a blockade on Gaza, where unemployment runs at about 50%, thus shutting the border once more to Arab laborers who were formerly employed in Israel. In recent days, just before cutting this tape, they have allowed percentages of those workers through the checkpoints, searching the bags and everything that they carry, of course, and that is the only way that many of them can feed their families. In a gesture toward the Palestinians, Netanyahu also set free convicted members of Hamas, one of the most violent of the various Arab fundamentalist terrorist organizations. And despite these and other gestures, Netanyahu said, and listen to this, he said he had incontrovertible evidence that the Palestinian Authority, that's the new name for the PLO, was deliberately inciting these recent terrorist acts. Now that says to me, and it ought to say to anyone, that when he says he has incontrovertible evidence, you can just about bank on the fact that the Mossad has deeply penetrated the Palestinian Authority. Yasser Arafat's speeches plainly confirm that claim. To the Western media, Arafat comes across as mild and conciliatory. However, when speaking before a rally in Gaza calling for jihad holy war and announcing the most recent suicide bombing of civilians in Jerusalem, he was shouting, waving his hands about, screaming out various slogans, and when they heard of the murder of these innocent Israeli civilians, his audience, numbering up into the many, many thousands, began screaming, God is great, God is great, God is great, celebrating the death of women and babies as a result of a suicide bomber in a coffee shop in Tel Aviv. In the office of Yasser Arafat, if you were to go there, there's a map of Palestine on the wall, but there are no borders showing the state of Israel to even exist. It's merely a map of Palestine. Notwithstanding the PLO's agreement to change their charter to eventually acknowledge the right of the state of Israel to exist, the charter remains unchanged. It calls for the destruction of the state of Israel. Millions of Americans that are heavily influenced by the liberal media seem to believe it is Israel who commits every single provocation, which then results in another outbreak of violence. Israel just has no business provoking those poor Arabs, they think. Things like daring to open the other end of a tunnel with an archaeological marvel, which, as I said, would exit inside the old city, thereby taking tourists into the streets where Arab shops display their wares. Well, that resulted in massive riots and violence. The Israelis' most recent provocation is daring to build housing inside sovereign Israel, inside the city limits of sovereign Jerusalem, their capital. To Israelis, of course, claiming that this is a provocation to the Palestinians to riot is tantamount to saying that the building of another skyscraper in Manhattan is a provocation to the earliest Indian inhabitants, or that building new housing inside Washington, D.C. is cause for America's enemies to attack us. But the major provocation to extremists among Palestinian Arabs is simply the existence of Israel. The Israelis want to live. Unfortunately, the Israelis say they are simply not willing to be led docilely to the gas chambers once again. They are not willing to cease to exist so the world can speak well of them, so the world can breathe a sigh of relief and say peace has come at last to the Middle East. You see, the Jewish inmates at Dachau and Buchenwald and Auschwitz, the Jewish hordes of men, women, and children who were herded like so many sheep above the cattle cars to be deported, the Jewish people who were stripped of their clothing and ordered into the gas chambers and then even had the final indignity and death of the gold in their teeth hammered out of their heads, were not armed. The Jewish inmates at Dachau were not armed. Israel is, to the teeth, and with nuclear weapons at that. Now, why terrorism? Why are so many of the Arabs so violently angry with the Jews? The major news media seem to reinforce the assumption that what is really happening in Israel is simply another struggle for independence. Did not the United States of America fight a war of independence? Have not countries all over the world wanted to be free of domination by other powers, free to pursue their own religious, philosophical, political, social, and economic goals? To the average man on the street, the indiscriminate killing of civilians in Israel may seem like the natural effect of an obvious cause. Israel continues to occupy the West Bank and so on. Well, 30 years have passed since Israel was attacked by six Arab armies and won an astonishing victory which resulted in the occupation of the disputed lands. Notwithstanding, the Palestinian Arabs and Syrians demand that Israel relinquish all lands won by force of arms, including East Jerusalem. From the Israeli point of view, they ask the question, why should we allow terrorists to dictate to us whether or not we can build homes in a neighborhood in Jerusalem any more than the United States would cave in to terrorists who demand that they do not develop housing in Washington, D.C. or San Francisco? But you see, the Palestinian Arabs have laid claim to Jerusalem, demanding that it become the capital of a new Palestinian state, and the roots of that conflict are buried deep in the past. So let's go into the past, and let's take a look at the history of Palestine. The term Palestine comes from Philistine, or Philistine, the name of a tribe that was in virtually a continual state of war with ancient Israel. Goliath, the giant whom David slew with a slingshot, was a Philistine, or a Palestinian. Mitzrayim, the second son of Ham, begat Casluhim, quote, out of whom came Philistim, That's in Genesis 10:14. It would be an error to assert that the present-day Palestinian Arabs are Philistines. The Philistines were not of Arab stock. Any history of the region is a chronicle of the many different peoples representing all three of the sons of Noah, of dozens of wars, of invasions from the major powers on all sides, Assyria, Babylonia, Egypt, Persia, Greece, Rome, Turkey, Europe, all in turn swept into Palestine. In more modern times, it was ruled by Seljuk and Ottoman Turks, and then by Britain from the time of World War I when Allenby defeated the Turks. The Philistines are said to be descendants of the Putasati, a confederation of peoples from northern Syria, Asia Minor, and the Levant, and that merely means the place of the going down of the sun, which is why they always call Lebanon the Lebanon, and that is the way it was always spoken of, which threatened Egypt's power in the 20th Egyptian dynasty. Egyptian monuments display the Putasati with distinctive headdresses of feathers, resembling that of the Lycaeans and the Mycenaeans. There's some confusion about the earliest origins of the Philistines, however. The Bible says they were immigrants from Kaftor in Amos 9 and verse 7. They appear in the land prior to the time of Moses and prior to the trial of Abraham concerning Isaac, therefore rendering it utterly impossible that they could have been Arabs. Listen to this from Genesis 21:32-34, quote, "Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. Then Abimelech rose up, and Phicol, or Phicol, the chief captain of his host, and they returned into the land of the Philistines. And Abraham planted a grove in Beersheba, and called there on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham sojourned in the Philistines' land many days." And the name Palestine comes from the name Philistine. Though they gave their name to the land, they were not the children of Ishmael. The Philistines are mentioned time and time again in the Bible. Hastings Bible Dictionary says, quote, "Politically, they had five principal centers, the cities of Ashdod, Gaza, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron." That's from 1 Samuel 6:17, from Joshua 13:3, and from Zephaniah 2:4-7. Their political organization was unique. They were distinguished especially for their military prowess. Pretty full details of their system might be gathered from various parts of the Bible, including mention of their archers, their equipment for heavy armed infantry, their organization into hundreds and thousands, and so on. And you'll find that in 1 Samuel 31:3, 1 Chronicles 10:3, 1 Samuel 29:2. The accounts make the impression that they usually fought as infantry, though chariots and cavalry are mentioned. We have descriptions also of their savage treatment of the bodies of their fallen enemies. You can find that in 1 Samuel 31. And in 1 Chronicles 10, and of the honors with which their women welcomed their warriors returning from victory. But more significant than all manners of detail is the fact that this little nation, with its few hundred square miles of territory, was able again and again to conquer Israel and to hold Israel in subjection for generations. You can look at that in Hastings Dictionary, Volume 3, pages 844 and 5. In the biblical account of David's victory over Goliath, it's noted that they had perfected the art of metallurgy. Goliath wore a coat of mail like that of Europeans. He had a helmet of brass and carried a huge spear with a massive iron head. You can read of that in 1 Samuel 17:4-7. Though the tables of nations in the 10th chapter of Genesis indicate that the original Philistines were probably Hamitic in origin, and therefore quite dark and swarthy, possibly even black, many authorities believe the name itself is of Semitic origin. And Hastings says, quote, "It was the Philistine policy to prevent the existence of a united Israel. As long as David is king of Judah, and as a rival king farther north, they seem to be content. When Israel is divided, the Philistine supremacy is not imperiled. But when it is proposed that David reign over all the 12 tribes, the Philistine armies march at once." 2 Samuel 5:17. A similar situation had arisen previously when Samuel became the judge of Israel, 1 Samuel 7:7. The present-day Gaza Strip is named after one of the five principal cities of the Philistines. Notice that the Philistines were an entirely different people than the Arabs who came from the east in Arabia. Quote from the Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition, volume 21, page 402. "Gaza, the most southerly and famous of the Philistine towns, was the terminus of the great caravan route from Edom," and that's modern-day Turkey, "and South Arabia, with whose Bedouin it was generally on good terms. It was the outpost of Africa, the door of Asia, the stepping-off point for the invasion of Egypt, and the fortress which, next in importance to Lachish, barred the maritime road to Phoenicia and Syria. It's necessary to realize Gaza's position and its links with trading centers. Such conditions in the comparatively small and half-desert land of Judah depended essentially upon its relations with the Edomites and the Arabian tribes on the southeast, with the Philistines on the west. The Bible itself makes that same distinction between Philistines and Arabians. I'm now quoting from 2 Chronicles 17:11. Quote, "Also some of the Philistines brought Jehoshaphat presents and tribute, silver, and the Arabians brought him flocks, 7,700 rams, and 7,700 he-goats. And Jehoshaphat waxed great exceedingly, and he built in Judah castles and cities of store. And he had much business in the cities of Judah, and the men of war, mighty men of valor, were in Jerusalem." The biblical story of the earliest inhabitants of Palestine begins with Abraham, who was the progenitor of both the Jews and the Arabs. Abraham was a descendant of Eber, and thus an Hebrew. God told Abraham, quote, "Get thee out of thy country," reading now from Genesis 12, 1 and 2, "and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and you shall be a blessing." In a sense, the entire Bible could be called one man's story, because it develops a continuous thread, commencing with the call of Abraham and ending with the prophecies of Christ as portrayed in the Olivet Prophecy and the Book of Revelation. His statement to the Pharisees, "You will see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of God, and you yourselves thrust out," plainly stated that Abraham will be in the kingdom of God with Christ. Abraham is called the father of the faithful, and is greatly revered by Jews and Arabs alike. Abraham's faith was to be tested almost at a breaking point, when he was told to sacrifice his only son for whom he had waited so long. Earlier, God had told him, "As for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and you shall be a father of many nations. Neither shall your name be more called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for a father of many nations have I made thee." And the name Abraham means father of many nations. God said, "I will make thee exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee." If you have not yet read my book entitled Europe and America in Prophecy, then by all means be sure to get your copy. It's absolutely free of charge if you call 903-825-2525. The story of Abraham's possession of the land of Palestine and the perpetual promises made to him by God is one of the most fascinating in all of history. And it's only by understanding the call of Abraham that you can truly gain a perspective on the whole history of the Middle East. In his recent joint news conference with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel following that bomb blast in Tel Aviv, King Hussein of Jordan spoke of both Jews and Arabs as, quote, "the children of Abraham," end of quote. Now, who are the Arabs? Abraham's children were prophesied to spread abroad to all points of the compass. His grandson Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, was to eventually number in the hundreds of millions, as the sand of the seashore, as it says in Genesis, the 22nd chapter, and spread abroad over all the earth. His son Ishmael became the progenitor of many of the Arabs. His grandson Esau, Jacob's brother, is the progenitor of the Edomites, commonly believed to be the Turkish people. Abraham's frustration over his wife Sarah's barrenness brought about his decision to engender children by his handmaiden, an Egyptian slave girl named Hagar. And that was with Sarah's consent, if not with her active insistence. You read of that in Genesis 16:1-6. I won't read it all, but Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children, it says, and she had an handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "Behold now, the Eternal has restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her." And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. Well, as you read the story, eventually, when she was expecting, there became a very great conflict between she and Sarai. And that last verse, verse 6, says, "Sarai said to Abram, my wrong be upon thee, I have given my maid into thy bosom. And when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Eternal judge between me and thee." You see, Abraham loved Sarah deeply. So he told Sarah to do as she pleased with Hagar, for after all, she was Sarah's handmaiden. Sarah began treating her so harshly that Hagar fled. An angel spoke to her, and she had to return. You can find all of this, by the way, in the 16th chapter of the book of Genesis. She was sitting out there thinking that they were both near death, and she couldn't bear to watch her child die, when an angel of the Eternal spoke to her and showed her that there was a spring nearby and told her to go back. And here's what the angel said. I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. This is Hagar now, being promised that her son Ishmael, who is the progenitor of most of the Arabs, would become a multitude. The angel of the Eternal said unto her, Behold, thou art with child, and shall bear a son, and shall call his name Ishmael, meaning God hears. You see, God named Ishmael, because the Eternal has heard your affliction. And he will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And, note this well, he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. And Hagar bare Abram a son, and Abram called his son's name, which Hagar bare, Ishmael. Now that was 11 years before Abraham, as he was named later, before Abraham arrived in the land of Canaan. Ishmael was prophesied to become the progenitor of 12 princes, just like Jacob was to be the progenitor of 12 princes, each of whom would become a chieftain, in the case of Ishmael, of a tribe in his own right. When God renewed his promise to Abraham of a son through Sarah, it's obvious Abraham had become very attached to Ishmael, because when the proposition came that he would have a son of Sarah, he said, Oh, that Ishmael could live before thee. Couldn't you fulfill this promise through my son Ishmael? Abraham loved Ishmael. He did not despise him. But God told Abraham, quote, As for Ishmael, this is Genesis 17, 20 and 21, I have heard thee. Behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. 12 princes shall he beget, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant will I establish with Isaac, which Sarah shall bear unto thee at this set time in the next year. Genesis 17, 20 and 21. No doubt many of the servants of Abraham looked upon Ishmael as his logical heir. Ishmael was 14 when Isaac was born, and a great feast was held to celebrate the occasion. And you read of that in Genesis 21, 8 to 13. It is a fascinating story. I won't quote it all here. But the name Isaac means laughter because it harks back to the time when Sarah laughed upon hearing that she would bear a son in her old age. You read of that in Genesis 18:12. Eventually, because of jealousy, partly brought to the fore by that great feast in celebration of the birth of Isaac, Sarah expelled Hagar and her teenage son. And that's when that event occurred that I mentioned in passing just previously, where you see that the angel actually showed her a spring, and instead of the boy dying and his mother along with him, they were both saved. It says in Genesis 21:17-21, that as she was there about to die, God called to her and said, What ails thee, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him in thine hand, for I will make of him a great nation. And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the bottle with water and gave the lad to drink. And God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took him a wife out of the land of Egypt. Genesis 21:17-21. Hagar no doubt wanted her son to marry from among her own people. Kiddo's Bible Encyclopedia says, quote, The wilderness of Paran, lying along the western side of the Arabah, that means the desert, between Canaan and the mountains of Sinai, now became the home of Ishmael. Some of the border tribes with which the shepherds of Abraham were wont to meet and strive at the wells of Gerar, Beersheba, and En-Mishpat probably received and welcomed the outcast into their tents. His relationship to Abraham would also add to his personal claims. At this period, the Arabian desert appears to have been thinly populated by descendants of Joktan, the son of Eber, from whose name Hebrew derives, whose dwelling was from Mesha as you go to Sephar, a mount of the east, that's in Genesis 10:25-30. The Joktanites, or the Beni Katan, are regarded by Arabian historians as the first and most honorable progenitors of the Arab tribes. And you can read that in Arabia by Herbert Lowe, called the Oriental Bibliotheque, or Bibliotheque, and the term Arabs, or Arabes, in the Latin, is on the title of that book. The Joktanites have left traces of their names and settlements, chiefly in the southern and southeastern parts of the peninsula, while the Ishmaelites kept closer, listen to this, to the borders of Canaan. Isn't that interesting? The Arabs themselves say that they come both from Joktan, who is mentioned in the Tables of Nations in Genesis 10, and, in the main, from Ishmael, who is the son of Abraham through Hagar. Notice that at the time of the death of Abraham, Isaac and Ishmael were both there. Genesis 25:8-10. It says, Abraham gave up the ghost, that means he expired or exhaled his last, and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. And his son Isaac and Ishmael, his sons Isaac and Ishmael, both buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, which is before Mamre, the field which Abraham purchased of the sons of Heth. There was Abraham buried, and Sarah his wife. As the centuries passed, tens of thousands of people inhabited the Middle East who were related to Abraham. Because listen to this, in his great old age, Abraham sired 6 more sons and an uncounted number of daughters through Keturah. Then again, it says in Genesis 25:1-4, Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah. And she bare him Zimran, and Jokshan, and Medan, and Midian. Note that name. It was Midianites, and a priest of Midian, who gave Moses succor, and he married the daughter of a Midianitish priest, remember? A Midianitish priest, when he was in the wilderness prior to leading the nation of Israel out of the land of Egypt. So Midian was one of the sons of Abraham through another wife named Keturah. Also Ishbak and Shuah. And Jokshan begat Sheba and Dedan. And the sons of Dedan were Ashurim and Letushim and Luemim. And the sons of Midian were Ephah and Epher and Hanok and Abida and Eldah. All those were the children of Keturah, Genesis 25:1-4. Now, as you'll recall, Moses, many centuries later, was to marry the daughter of a Midianitish priest, and it was because it was accused of Moses by Aaron and Miriam that he had married, quote, a black woman, end quote, that they were expelled from the camp and had a momentary bout of leprosy, which God then miraculously healed. Do you remember that? That's fascinating because it shows you here that even though they were, quote, Semitic, by the time other tribes that were over there were intermarried with them, there were also Hamitic races that intermingled with some of them, and they are dark and very, very swarthy. And so the girl that we know from the motion pictures like the Ten Commandments and other movies they have made about the time of Moses that he married, who was the daughter of a Midianitish priest, was a very, very dark lady. And Moses' own son, no doubt, was a very dark and a swarthy young lad. Ishmael sired 12 sons and an unknown number of daughters. The Bible says this in Genesis 25:12-16. Now these are the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's handmaid, bare unto Abraham. And these are the names of the sons of Ishmael. So here you are given the eponymous ancestors or the progenitors of each of the 12 great princes, each of the 12 great nations, and nation doesn't mean political entity, by the way, that are the Arabs of today. These are the sons of Ishmael by their names, according to their generations, the firstborn of Ishmael, Nebajoth, and Kedar, and Abiel, and Mibsam, and Mishma, and Duma, and Massa, Hadar, and Tema, Jetur, Naphish, and Kadima. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their towns and by their castles, 12 princes according to their nations, Genesis 25:12-16. like Jacob, who was to sire 12 princes, each of whom would become the father of a nation. Ishmael was also to be the progenitor of 12 tribes or nations. And, of course, the word nation should not be understood in a political sense, but an ethnic sense only. The prophecy did not mean each son of Ishmael would become a king over a specific country or a political nation, but the progenitor of a tribe of people. Ishmael himself was prophesied to become, quote, a wild ass of a man, end quote, with, quote, his hand against every man and every man's hand against him, end quote. The term should not be understood as an insult, the way it would be used today. Rather, it implied a fierce, hardy, untamed man of the desert, a warrior who would always dwell near his brethren. Writing of the history of the Bedouin tribes of the Arab nations of the last century, Kitto said, and I quote, "Nearly 4,000 years have passed since the Ishmaelites became a nation, and yet in disposition, in manners, in habits, in government, in occupation, and even in dress, they are the same as they were at the first." That's from Kitto's Bible Cyclopedia, Volume 2, page 431. As the centuries passed, and as the children of Abraham through Keturah mingled with the children of Abraham through Hagar and Ishmael, many different Middle Eastern tribes developed. Eventually, they occupied vast areas from near India in the east to the Mediterranean, and gradually spread across all of northern Africa and even up into the Balkan states, up into Turkey and across into European Turkey and eventually into the Balkan states around the mouth of the Danube River. This now quoting from that same source, Kitto's Bible Cyclopedia, quote, "And it has not been on the confines of their own desert home only that the hand of the Ishmaelite has been against every man. Inspired by the fierce fanaticism and led by the daring chiefs of Mohammed, they carried their victorious arms to the banks of the Oxus and the Indus on the east, that's over in India, and over Syria, Egypt, northern Africa, and Spain, to the shores of the Atlantic on the west." Do you know that the Moors, who inhabited Spain, who were Islamic, their original peoples, the Berbers and some of those tribes of northern Africa and the desert areas of Tunisia, of Libya, of Morocco, and Algiers are also some of the children of Ishmael? The term Moor has an interesting derivation, and it does not necessarily describe just one tribe of people, but they actually ruled for a time in Spain, as you well remember. And, of course, a lot of their music in Spain today is Moorish and has a definite Middle Eastern flavor to it if you ever hear the flamenco kind of music that is a part of the heritage of the Moors. For many centuries, the purest Arabs, as they call themselves, were known as Bedouins. And the word Bedouin only meant a dweller in the open land. The term is, quote, "the name given the most important, as is the best known, division of the Arab race. The Bedouins are the descendants of the Arabs of North Arabia, whose traditions claim Ishmael as their ancestor. The deserts of North Arabia seem to have been their earliest home, but even in ancient times they had migrated to the lowlands of Egypt and Syria. The Arab conquest of northern Africa in the 7th century A.D. caused a wide dispersion, so that today the Arab element is strongly represented in the Nile Valley. And by the way, most modern citizens of Egypt are Arabs, not ethnic Egyptians. More on that a little later on. The Arab element is also strongly represented in all of the Saharan nations, and of course among the Nubian peoples, and down in the Sudan. The earliest known traditions among the Arabs of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, and the name Saudi is strictly a family or a tribal name, are that their people are derived from two stocks, and they are, quote, "the pure Arabs descending from Khatan or Joktan, fourth in descent from Shem, and the Mustarab or naturalized Arabs," that's all Mustarab meant, naturalized Arab or Arab, "descended from Ishmael. Therefore, according to their own traditions, the many Arab nations represent a mixture of Hamitic and Semitic stocks." The same authority says, and I quote, "Arabia is a land of Semites, and is supposed by some scholars to have been the original home of the Semitic people. Although this cannot be said to be proved, the studies, linguistic and archaeological, of Semitic scholars have shown it to be very probable. The dispersion from Arabia is easy to imagine.
The migration into Babylonia was simple, as there are no natural boundaries to separate it from Northeast Arabia. The connection with Palestine has always been close. Arabian literature has its own version of prehistoric times, but is entirely legendary and apocryphal. And that is from the Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition, volume 3, page 623. Now, who were the earliest inhabitants of Palestine? History proves that many people bear the names that are given to them by others, sometimes the names attached to them by their enemies. As an example, the word Teuton, attached to the fierce warlike tribes in Central Europe north of the Roman Limes, merely meant spear thrower. The name Deutschland for Germany and Dutch for the people of Holland has that ancient origin. It is important to note that the names for nationalities almost never reveal their true ethnic origin. An American is a citizen of the United States of America, which name came from the first name of the Italian explorer Americus Vespucci. Yet an American can come from dozens of different ethnic origins. Hundreds of modern nations bear names which do not remotely describe their earliest inhabitants or even their subsequent occupants. Christopher Columbus, completely confused, supposed he had landed in India, and so called the aboriginal inhabitants he encountered Indians. And the name has stuck to this day. There are dozens of other examples everywhere in the world. As another important point, remember that the peoples living in Egypt today are not the same people as the Egyptians in the days of the pharaohs and the Exodus. They are Arabs, not ethnic Egyptians. Study the origins of the gypsies in that regard, who themselves say they came from Little Egypt and had a color and an ethnic origin and certain abilities and talents and characteristics, as well as a language which was absolutely unknown from all of the countries and the lands through which they emigrated all the way over into Europe and into England and eventually to the United States and around the world. There were hundreds of thousands of gypsies in Romania, in Bulgaria, over in the Eastern Slavic countries of Europe. And they all said they came from Little Egypt and had very strange dress and customs that hark back to some of the monuments that you will see in ancient Egypt. Of course, the word gypsy means Egyptian, an Egyptian. Many of the tribes in Palestine from very early times were given names by others according to where they dwelt or because they possessed certain characteristics. Though some of the names of tribes in Palestine at the time of the Exodus are questionable, the best scholarship lists them thusly. The Hittites, according to Genesis 23, extended to Hebron in an early age, but were driven out of central Palestine before the Exodus by Thutmose III. The Philistines, said to appear on monuments as early as 1200 BC, and whose god Dagon was worshipped at Ashkelon in the 15th century BC, are thought to have been of Cretan origin. But the remaining tribes bear Semitic names such as Canaanites, and that apparently merely meant lowlanders that dwelt in the Sharon and the Jordan Valley. That's all Canaanite meant. The land of Canaan, or a Canaanite, meant a dweller, in the valley. The Perizzites merely meant people who dwelt in villagers, or were villagers, or dwelt in little hamlets or villages. Kenites merely meant spearmen. The Kenizzites merely meant hunters. And the Kadomites merely meant those of the east. The same cannot be said, however, of the Amalekites, who seem to have lived even in central Palestine, according to Judges 12:15, though they're usually spoken of as a tribe in the desert south of Palestine, or of the Girgashites, perhaps near Girgisa. The population thus seems to have originally included three distinct stocks, though many of the above names may be descriptive. The Hittites and Amorites alone are known by their monuments. The first, a hairless race. Get this, it's fascinating. You've heard of the Hittites. You read of them in the book of Genesis. They were a hairless race with slanting eyes and pigtails, and apparently were Mongol. It isn't that they migrated there from Mongolia so much as they were there from the earliest days of the scattering of the races after the Tower of Babel and eventually migrated to the east. But the Hittites, who were there in the land, even when Israel occupied the land of Palestine, were definitely not of Shem or of Ham, but of Japheth. The latter, that is, the Girgashites, were a darker people, bearded and black-haired, with aquiline Semitic features. This by the monuments that they themselves drew and etched in stone as they attempted to depict themselves. The Hebrew groups, including Ammonites, Moabites, and the half-breed Ishmaelites and Edomites, were distinguished by language from the earliest inhabitants or the aboriginal dwellers in the land of Palestine. Shortly after the confusion of languages at the Tower of Babel, the various tribes of Shem, Ham, and Japheth began overspreading the land. Japheth largely went to the east, Shem westerly, Ham from the Middle East southward. However, from the very earliest times, as we have just discussed, there were representatives of all three of those basic racial stocks living in parts of Palestine. The people of Sodom and Gomorrah were probably Hamitic. The Hittites were probably Japhetic, but the Ishmaelites and descendants of Joktan were Semitic. The earliest Philistines were not Arab stock, even though their name is attached to the land, but were Hamitic. Now notice this, and this actually is a part of the Bible right out of Genesis, the 10th chapter. Out of that land went forth Asher and built Nineveh and the city Rehoboth and Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, the same as a great city. And Mitzrayim begat Ludim and Anamim and Lehabim and Naphtuhim and Pathrusim and Kalushim, out of whom came Philistim. Interesting, isn't it? And that is Hamitic. And the word Philistim, or the Philistines, was actually Hamitic. So they were not Arab stock, even though their name is attached to the land. People think of a Palestinian Arab as being an ethnic term. It is not. It is merely geographical. And the geographical term came from an Hamitic group of people who came right out of Ham and is listed in the tables of nations in Genesis, the 10th chapter. And Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, and the Arvadite, and the Zemarite, and the Hamathite. And afterward were the families of the Canaanites spread abroad. And the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon, and that's up along the borders, you know, with Israel and Lebanon, in Lebanon actually today, as you come to Gerar, unto Gaza, all the way down toward the Nile Delta, on a strip of land heading toward Egypt from modern-day Israel. These are the sons of Ham, it says in Genesis 10, after their families, after their tongues, in their countries, and in their nations. Ham was a black man and is the progenitor of the black races, of which there are dozens of varieties. So it is that we see that the entire region of Palestine and the Mideast, including the valley of the Tigris and Euphrates, or Mesopotamia, which merely means land between the rivers, commonly called the cradle of civilization, was originally overspread by all three representatives of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Eventually, the lands of the Middle East were settled primarily by Semitic people, even though earlier families of Hamitic stock were also to be found among the maritime plains and the Mediterranean seacoast. It is very important to realize that many of the peoples that were dispossessed by the Israelites after the Exodus were not Arabs at all, but were Hamitic peoples, and some of them may even have been Japhetic. As already mentioned, the Arabs trace their ancestry back to Eber's second son, Joktan, and to Ishmael and his children. Even prior to the First World War, the Encyclopedia Britannica stated, quote, "The Arab people, according to their own traditions, are derived from two stocks, the pure Arabs descended from Katan or Joktan, fourth in descent from Shem, and the Mustarab or naturalized Arabs from Ishmael," which I read to you a little earlier. When the newly formed nation of Israel passed through the Sinai Desert then, 40 years later, crossed over the Jordan River into the land of Palestine, they found the land inhabited by many different tribes, some of which were of giant size. So much so that the spies who had been sent to search out the land were in terror of the giants they had seen and called them the people of Anak, or the Anakim, and the Amalekites, and the Hittites, a hairless people with slant eyes and pigtails. The Jebusites, the Amorites, and the Canaanites merely mean dwellers in the valley. The Amorites dwelt in the mountains, the Canaanites dwelt along the seacoast and along the west bank of the Jordan. And you can see that in Numbers, the 13th chapter. Remember, Canaan was a son of Ham, not a son of Shem. Though many have referred to Palestine as the land of Canaan, the term does not connote Arabian stock. I think it's very important for people to come to understand this. Many people assume that when Israel inherited the promised land, from that time onward, Israel was pushing Arabs out of their land, that this was Arabian stock, that these were Arabs who lived there. Absolutely not. No, no. They always dwelt in the other side of the Jordan and to the east of their brethren. Now, because of that near revolt and their faithlessness toward God, it was predicted that none of them from 20 years of age and above would inherit the land in Numbers 14, 29 to 32. Only the younger ones would cross over the Jordan and inherit that land. History will tell you that the term Canaanite has been the subject of a great deal of dispute, because instead of attaching it to the earliest inhabitants of Canaan, the son of Ham, it has been attached to many other peoples who inhabited the land of Palestine over the centuries. The Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition, says Canaan, referring to the land, not Ham's son, in particular, is shown to be an Arabian name. It is now no mere hypothesis that beginning from about 4000 BC, a wave of Semitic migration poured out of Arabia and flooded Babylonia, certainly, and possibly more or less Syria and Palestine also. The term Canaanites was used for many different tribes who inhabited the land of Palestine from the Jordan Valley to the Mediterranean. The proof of that is found in the book of Zephaniah, Zephaniah 2:5. Zephaniah prophesied, quote, "Woe to the inhabitants of the seacoast, the nation of the Cherethites! The word of the Lord is against you, O Canaan, the land of the Philistines. I will even destroy thee, that there shall be no inhabitant." End of quotation. The term Canaanite has been the subject of a lot of dispute because of the fact that many people attached it to the earliest descendants of Canaan, the son of Ham, and has been attached to many other peoples who inhabited the land of Palestine over the centuries. The Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition, says this: Canaan, referring to the land, not Ham's son, in particular, is shown to be an Arabian name. Now, it is no mere hypothesis that beginning from about 4000 BC, a wave of Semitic migration poured out of Arabia and flooded Babylonia, certainly, and possibly, more or less, Syria and Palestine also. Also, that between 2800 and 2600 BC, a second wave from Arabia took the same course, covering not only Babylonia, but also Syria and Palestine, and probably also Egypt, referring to the Hyksos. The history books will tell you that from the early Bronze Age, commencing about 3000 BC, successive waves of Semites, and that comes, of course, from the term from Shem, the son of Noah, and progenitor of all the Arabs and all the Israelitish tribes, too, moved in to Palestine. In 1479 BC, Thutmose III of Egypt conquered the region. Egyptian control was challenged by other newly arriving immigrants, the Habiru. And that referred to Hebrews, but it didn't mean Jews, by the way. It merely meant the descendants of Eber, who were from Mesopotamia. And, of course, Abraham came from there originally. Amorites from the Lebanon, and Hittites from Anatolia, or modern-day Turkey. It was not until 1200 to 1000 B.C. that the Philistines, which meant peoples of the sea, established themselves along the Aegean and the maritime plain of modern-day Palestine. As has been discussed, the Hittites may well have been Japhethic. Around 1225 B.C., the Israelites crossed the River Jordan following their hundreds of years captivity in Israel and settled the land. The Encyclopedia Americana says, quote, "After 1150 B.C., Egyptian control of Palestine slackened, and with the Philistines in a role of catalytic agent, unification of the 12 tribes of Israel took place, under their first king Saul and his two great successors, David and Solomon. At the time of his death in 973 B.C., David had conquered Jerusalem, made it his capital, and broken the power of the Philistines." At no time was Jerusalem ever the political capital of any Arab state. Let me repeat that. At no time, all the way back to the most ancient history, was Jerusalem ever the political capital of any Arab state. It's important to remember that Israel occupied the land of Palestine after the Exodus when no such religion as Islam existed. The peoples of early Palestine were entirely heathen. Many of them practiced infant sacrifice. They were polytheistic, worshiping Baal, which really was nothing more than Nimrod or Isis, and various versions of Semiramis or Ishtar, pronounced Easter, the mother wife of Nimrod and founder of the Babylonish mystery religion. Islam, or Mohammedanism, the creation of Mahomet, did not appear on the world scene until more than 6 centuries after the birth of Christianity and more than 3 centuries after the Council of Nicaea in 325 A.D. The religion of the Middle East was at first that of the patriarchs following the flood, then of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and finally that of Israel when they were brought out of slavery in Egypt and into the Promised Land. There are marked similarities between the religion of Islam and that of Moses. And Muslims, of course, claim a distinct relationship to Abraham, not only religiously, but ethnically as well. The faith called Islam, as it was called by its founder Mahomet, or Muhammad if you prefer, it's spelled variously in the histories, is virtually universal among the Arab races. Its roots are found in the life and the teachings of Muhammad, or Mahomet, who died according to tradition on June 7, 632 A.D., or in Arab reckoning, 11 A.H., meaning after the Hegira or the Hajj. The term means submission. Islam merely means submission or to surrender. Allegedly, according to Arab historians, it finds its roots in the total surrender of Abraham's will to God in the circumstance of the near sacrifice of Isaac, as well as Isaac's docile surrender to his father's will and purpose. It is presumed that Mahomet built his religion on this concept that he came among the Jews where he lived in Mecca, later on in Medina, and that he actually borrowed many of the concepts of the religion of Abraham, and that then he began to claim to become a prophet or an apostle. And at different times he used both terms. And by the way, the latter term is really a term of the Bible and is not an Arabic term at all, but Mahomet claimed to be a prophet or an apostle. Since he claimed to be the only spokesman for God, he eventually became the, quote, divinely appointed dictator, end quote, of his community. To disobey him would result in divine vengeance overtaking the disobedient. Mahomet's earliest visions were said to have been accomplished by wrapping himself in a blanket, entering into a trance, and then, preceded by copious perspiration, uttering oracles or prayers. According to Mahomet, he was directed, at first, or so he said, to communicate his visions only to his nearest relatives, and probably because no one else would believe him. But eventually his followers began urging him to come forward, and that ultimately resulted in his ouster from Mecca and the Hegira, or his famous flight to Medina. The date for that event is the same for Islam as B.C. or A.D. would be in nominal Christianity, which means before Christ or Anno Domini or the year of our Lord for Christians. The Encyclopedia Britannica 11th edition says, and I quote, "Rejecting accounts of Mahomet's first appearance as a public preacher, which are evidently comments on a text of the Koran, we have reason for supposing that his hand was forced by ardent followers who many times in his career compelled him to advance." The astute rulers of the community perceived that the claim made by Mahomet was to be dictator or autocrat, and while this was naturally ridiculed by them, some appeared to have been devoted adherents of the gods or goddesses whom he attacked. Apparently there was a war of words because Mahomet was trying to wrest those people away from various polytheistic, heathenistic, and paganistic religions. And this was followed by a resort to diplomacy, and then finally, force, a period in which Mahomet's attention was directed to foreign conversions, which resulted in his being offered and accepting the dictatorship of Yathrib. But Yathrib, an Arabic town in Arabia, was afterwards known as Medina. There were 2 important tribes in Yathrib called the Aus and the Khazraj, which were engaged in a feud at the time. There was also a significant Jewish community in Yathrib, or Medina. In a series of battles between the two feuding tribes, the Aus were bested by the Khazraj, a difficult name to pronounce, spelled K-H-A-Z-R-A-J. The Jews took no part in the feud, but ultimately were compelled to fight on the side of the Aus in the Battle of Bu'ath. Mahomet had used a divine title, which the Jews recognized, Rahman, and that name is common among Muslims today. When the battle was won, he said it was no doubt divine intervention. As Mahomet preached his ideas to the people of Medina, some of his first converts appeared to have been members of that Khazraj tribe, and desiring to secure the aid of the Israelitish deity during their next conflict with the Aus, they began to get close to Mahomet and begin to adopt and to embrace some of his ideas. The Encyclopedia Britannica 11th edition states, quote, "For this, the plan was substituted of inviting the prophet to come to Mecca as dictator to heal the feud and restore order, a procedure to which Greek antiquity offers parallels. The new converts were told to carry on secret propaganda in Yathrib with this end in view. At the next feast, some of the rival faction embraced Islam, or the teachings of Mahomet." A trusty follower of Mahomet, Mus'ab Umair, who resembled Mahomet in personal appearance, was sent to Yathrib to assist in the work. We first hear, at this time, the conditions of Islam, which by this time Mahomet had had a long time to think through and to prepare and to lay down. That is, a series of undertakings into which the convert entered. Namely, he had to abstain from adultery, from theft, infanticide, and lying, and he had to obey Mahomet in everything, in licitus et honestis, or completely and honestly. The wholesale conversion of Yathrib was determined by that of two chieftains, Usayd bin Harith and Sa'd bin Mu'adh, both of whom were Ausites. The example of these quickly followed. Others were following along as these tribe leaders were converted to it, and iconoclasm against some of the old heathen religion became rife in the area. At the next Meccan feast, a deputation of 70 Yathribites brought Mahomet a formal invitation, which he accepted after imposing certain conditions. By force of his personality and claims of divine authority, Mahomet had managed to deeply affect not only the Aus and the Yathribites, but, as is now seen, by the magnates of Mecca as a bitter enemy. That same authority says, although the transactions with the people of Yathrib had been carried on with profound secrecy, the nature of Mahomet's contract with the new adherents was somewhat divulged to the Meccan magnates, and the danger of allowing an implacable enemy to establish himself on the high road of their northbound caravans had to occur to them. The rule which forbade bloodshed in the sacred city had at last to be suspended, but elaborate precautions were to be taken whereby every tribe, except the clan that Mahomet himself represented, should have their share of the guilt, which would thus be spread over the whole community fairly. When the committee appointed to perpetrate the crime they had intended putting him to death reached Mahomet's house, they found out it was too late. Mahomet had already departed, leaving Ali in his bed. So he escaped because he learned of a conspiracy in which they were going to murder him. There is substantial literature available concerning Mahomet's raids on caravans, including the name of the very first person to be killed while fighting against a Muslim force. He, the unfortunate man, was Amr al-Hadrami, a member of a caravan attacked by the followers of Mahomet at the beginning of the sacred month of Rajab. Mahomet had decided to take advantage of his professed power to bind and to loose, so he had ordered the attack at a time when raiding was unknown and the caravans felt safe. A few months later, Mahomet organized a raid against a caravan returning from Syria, which had evaded him the previous year. A band of 300 were organized, including a large number of adherents who called themselves helpers. The leader of the caravan somehow learned of the impending attack and so hurried home by forced marches. Later, a major battle was fought between Meccans and the followers of Mahomet on March 17, 624 A.D., in which Mahomet won a decisive victory to which he attributed divine intervention. He alleged that God had dispatched a regiment of angels to fight on his side, while he said the devil had confused the Meccans. The Britannica says, in the narratives which have come down and which seem to be authentic, the result is amply accounted for by the excellence of the Muslim discipline and the complete absence of any on the Meccan side. Muhammad himself is said to have fainted at the first sight of blood and to have remained during the battle in a hut built for him to which swift camels were tied to be used in a case of a defeat. Yet these accounts make him responsible for the tactics while assigning the credit for the strategy to one Hobab Mondir. Several of Muhammad's old enemies and friends of Meccans perished on that occasion, notably one Akbu Jahal, his uncle, but represented as an implacable enemy, and other hostile uncle who is Abu Lahab, who is cursed in the Quran, but not present there, but died shortly after the battle. This is a very important date, by the way, in Mohammedan tradition. It's called the Day of Deliverance. The story of supernatural aid for Muhammad soothed the feelings of the defeated Meccans. Muhammad gained in popularity and was able to strike at his enemies in Medina. The same authority says, one of the sequels to the victory was a series of assassinations whereby critics of his actions were removed. And by the way, the term assassin was originally the name for a secret murderer and derives from the familiar hashish. This is a strange connection, isn't it? An opiate made from the juice of hemp leaves. The hashishin, or those who were smoking hashish, became assassin, which was originally the name of a branch of the Shiite sect of the Muslims known as the Ishmaelites, founded by Hassan ibn Saba. Fascinating bit of history. The word assassin came from hashish, or from those who were smoking it, because they could get up their courage to sneak in and to commit a secret murder. Muhammad eventually subdued Mecca, and some years later the entire Arabian Peninsula. His horizons continually expanded. The conquest of Persia is said to have been contemplated by the Prophet as early as after Hegira 5, when the famous trench was being dug, but it was not till the year AH 7, on the eve of taking of Mecca, that the Prophet conceived of sending missives to all known sovereigns and potentates, promising them safety if, but only if, they embraced Islam. Thus it was that Muhammad envisioned eventual world conquest. He claimed throughout that his revelation confirmed the Jewish and Christian scriptures, and this claim is on the whole reasonable, though his acquaintance with both was in the highest degree vague and inaccurate. Still, he reproduced the Old Testament as faithfully as he could, and though he patriotically endeavors to shed some luster on his supposed ancestor Ishmael, he does not appear to have questioned the biblical theory according to which the founder of the North Arabian nations was the son of a slave girl. He even allows that Israel was the chosen people. Of course, the Arabic name for God is Allah, and it's similar in origin to the Hebrew Eloah or Elohim. For the many names, titles, and attributes of God in the Bible, you ought to see the Divine Names and Titles section under the name God in the Oxford King James Version of the Bible or the Notes and Appendices in the Companion Bible by Bullinger. There are many similarities between Islam and Judaism, but there are also marked differences. As a monotheistic religion, Islam insists in its first and primary article of faith that there is no God but Allah, which is one of the most common statements in Islamic doctrine. So they believe that God is one. They say that He is preexistent or before all things, that He is omnipotent and omniscient, all-powerful and all-knowing. They believe He is the creator of all things, and according to the Quran, that He, quote, begets not and is not begotten, nor is there like unto Him anyone, end of quote. As the second most important article of faith, it is believed that Muhammad, or Muhammad, is a messenger of God in the tradition of Noah, Abraham, Moses, or even Jesus Christ. Islamic Arabs believe Jesus Christ was a prophet, but don't accept Him as Messiah. Rather, they believe that Muhammad was the last and greatest of all the prophets, and that He ascended to heaven from the site of the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. As Christians, or at least some of them, believe the Bible is the revealed Word of God, Islamic Arabs believe the Quran is the Word of God, which they think was dictated word by word by the Archangel Gabriel. Another belief is that the Quran should only be studied and repeated in the original tongue, or Arabic, and that the original Quran is in heaven, the seventh heaven, guarded by angels, and is there in the hands of God. As in the Levitical rites of purification, Muslims believe no one should ever touch the Koran unless he first undergoes rites of purity and various ablutions. As in the Bible, Muslims believe in angels, that they're superior beings to humans, and the names attached to them are similar to those in the Bible. Like a starving man wishes for food and water, so it would seem the dwellers of the desert pictured paradise or heaven as a place of shade and water, of comforts, relaxation, enjoyment, and sensual satisfaction. Here is what the Quran states, and I'm quoting, "He hath awarded them for all that they endured, such as dying in warfare or blowing themselves to bits aboard an Israeli bus, I might add, with paradise and silk attire, reclining therein upon couches. Naught shall they know of sun or bitter cold. Its shades close upon them, and lo, shall its fruits hang down. Vessels of silver are brought round for them, and goblets like flagons, flagons made of silver whose measure they themselves shall meet. There they are given a drink, a cup whereof the mixture is of ginger from the fount named Salsbil. There go round among them boys of everlasting youth, whom, when thou seest, thou wouldst take for scattered pearls. And when thou lookest at this, thou wilt see bliss and high estate. Their raiment will be of fine green silk and gold brocade. With silver bracelets will they be adorned, and their Lord will give them drink of a pure beverage." End of quote. That is from the Quran, 76:12-12. Nothing is said there about what pure beverage it is to be drunk in the Islamic version of heaven, nor why such mundane metals as silver and gold or fruits which are entirely biological are to be found in paradise. Many religions envision escape from the mundane to some higher level of existence, and even though they admit to such a transition as being entirely spiritual, they tend to believe in purely physical, sensual rewards such as leisure, fine clothing, luxurious homes, fine foods, unlimited enjoyment of the five senses, which is really ludicrous and illogical, since it is supposedly only the soul or the spirit which enters paradise and not a physical metabolic organism which depends upon food and drink for its survival. Islamic believers also envision a final judgment day. They believe in the immortality of the soul. And remarkably, like millions of nominal Christians, believe in an ever-burning hellfire where the damned are to be tortured eternally. Eventually, Islamic teachers explain that hell consisted of seven divisions, where evildoers are consigned to varying degrees of torture depending upon the degree of their evil. Now, like many other religions, including some of the New Age adherents and believers in aliens from outer space or a mothership trailing along behind a comet, the entire religion of Islam is founded upon the concept of the immortality of the soul. If you have not yet read it, you ought to call 903-825-2525 for your copy of Do You Have an Immortal Soul? Unlike nominal Christianity, Islam is not merely a belief, essentially separate from one's life pursuits or practice. Millions of nominal Christians work together, play together, enjoy social contact, yet attend different churches and believe very different things. Islam, on the other hand, demands constant outward practice. No pastor of a nominal Christian church really knows whether his parishioners pray during the week or not, even though he may deliver any number of sermons exhorting them to do so. But Islam requires a verbal profession of God and verbal acknowledgement that only Muhammad is his prophet. There are five religious duties in Islam. The first is that I expressed above, public prayer. The second is to practice five legally prescribed acts of prayer every single day. In my many visits to the Middle East, I have many poignant memories of the recorded voices emanating from loudspeakers in the minarets and mosques from Amman to Cairo and from Jerusalem to Istanbul, echoing about the cities the call for prayer or to prayer, and then the prayers later on. In mosques all over the world of Islam, millions of Arabs kneel in orderly rows, listening to the prayers as they repeatedly press their foreheads to the carpet on the floor. Many wealthy Arabs from the oil-rich Middle East, such as Saudi Arabia, possess their own luxurious jet aircraft, including such massive planes as the Boeing 747, and I saw the interior sketch and design for one such aircraft being prepared for the King of Saudi Arabia that had a gyro-driven pointer mounted in a bubble in the ceiling of a lounge room, which always pointed toward Mecca, So no matter in which direction the plane was flying, at the required time, those on board could gather in the large lounge room, turn on a tape-recorded Islamic prayer, and bow toward Mecca. The third duty is almsgiving in Islam, which in the early years of the religion were collected by officials appointed for the purpose and were assumed to be used for the building of mosques and helping the poor. But as the religion spread across the world, the practice of almsgiving became more personal. Fasting is the fourth duty, and Ramadan, supposedly the month in which the Quran was revealed. Since the early calendar used by Muslims was a lunar one, Ramadan can rotate through the solar year, falling even in the heat of the summer. The fast, however, is to be endured only from dawn till sunset, and one can eat to the full from sunset until the following morning. The fifth obligation is to perform at least a once-in-a-lifetime pilgrimage to the holy places in Arabia, preferably Mecca. And the Arabic word for pilgrim is Hajj, and I can highly recommend to you a book called The Hajj by best-selling author Leon Uris of Exodus fame, which will give you fascinating insight into the attitudes of Arabs and Israelis who lived side by side in Palestine for decades prior to the creation of the State of Israel and the 1967 Six-Day War. There is a sixth and a final obligation, according to at least one Islamic sect, and that is the waging of jihad, or holy war. And that view sees Islam as occupying one zone of the world, a zone in which peace reigns. The other zone is occupied by non-Muslims, and it is the duty of every Muslim to bring them under the banner of Islam. One passage in the Quran states, and I'm now quoting, "Fight in the path of God against those who fight against you, but be not the aggressors, for verily God loveth not the aggressors, and slay them wherever you find them, and drive them out of the places whence they drove you out, for persecution is worse than slaughter." End of quote. Rather a self-contradictory statement, isn't it? It's reminiscent of the conditions during the last part of World War II when the infamous kamikaze or divine wind suicide bombers of Japan blew up so many American ships and killed so many people. That kind of fanaticism is evident when suicide bombers will blow themselves to bits aboard crowded buses or in busy coffee shops and shopping centers in Israel. Average nominal Christians who believe in the teachings of Jesus Christ, who said, "Love your enemies and turn the other cheek," find it very difficult to understand the depths of such hatred or fanatical belief. To average nominal Christians, this physical life is precious, a gift from God during which one should strive to follow the teachings of Christ and the Bible. Unfortunately, there is very little defense against a determined suicide bomber, as events over many years in Israel have proven. The teachings of Muhammad eventually spread throughout the Middle East and Africa, found its way to Pakistan and Malaysia, and to the Philippines and Indonesia. Today, every seventh human being on earth is an adherent to Islam. Mahomet lived in Mecca, which city appears nowhere in biblical records. Its pre-Islamic religion was almost certainly pagan and featured a sanctuary shaped of a black stone called the Cube, or in Arabic, Kaaba. During the 4th century of Islam, the black stone was stolen by the Carmathians, but afterwards returned. We need to understand how nominal Christianity and Islam arrived in Palestine and in Egypt. We need to understand the origin of the Copts and the Coptic Christian Church. We need to understand about the Abbasids, the Seljuk Turks, and the Ottomans, the Seljuks reigning in Turkey and throughout the entire Arabic world and all the way to Vienna, to the distant borders of India from the 10th, 11th, and the 12th century. We need to understand about the Umayyads, about the Ottoman Turkish Empire, and how it reigned supreme in that area all the way to World War I. We need to understand about how Tsar Nicholas, responding actually to a controversy between Eastern Orthodox monks and Roman Catholics over the holy places in Jerusalem, triggered the Crimean War. There is a great deal more which I will have to put off for tape number 2 in this series. We will go through Israel, Jordan, and the Palestinian refugees. In the next tape, I will read to you the actual Balfour Declaration, which is so hated by the Arabs, and give you quotations from a personally autographed book from Prince Hassan, the brother of King Hussein, who gave me his own personal book about Palestinian self-determination, a study of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I will read to you a fantastic ad which was put on posters all over Britain after World War II, warning the English people that the Jewish people were going to fight and strike to the very heart of the empire if the British did not eventually abandon Palestine. I will give you information about Egypt under Sadat, of my personal talk with Sadat, and how, as I will tell you in that next tape, I think that there may have been something in that personal talk which resulted only a few months later in the visit of Anwar Sadat, a very surprise visit to Israel to visit Menachem Begin in Jerusalem. That, and going through Matthew 24, Luke 21, the abomination of desolation, and what Jesus meant when he said, "You will see armies surrounding Jerusalem," will come in tape number 2. The material you've been listening to is from a major new booklet that I am just now completing, which is going to be a very substantial booklet, and I've only been able to get through about one-third of it on this first 1 hour and 1 half tape. If you keep watching the television program, and of course remain on our mailing list to get our regular monthly announcements, you will see when the second tape in this series will be available, and also when the booklet will be finished.